Head to the episode details and follow the link for promotional offers from PRST affiliates like Nike, Reebok, Under Armour, Rogue Fitness, Hylete, Oakley, and several others. As always, thanks for tuning in.
What's going on, everyone? Thanks for tuning in to another episode. Today, I sit down with Dr. Dustin Grooms to talk about neuroplasticity associated with ACL injury. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and leave a review. You can find my content on Instagram and Twitter, where my handle is PRST_PT. You can follow my Facebook page, Performance Rehabilitation and Strength Training, and you can check out my website, agprst.weebly.com. I hope you enjoy the episode. The Performance Rehabilitation and Strength Training Podcast provides a platform for some of sports medicine's most influential individuals to collaborate. Tune in as some of the field's most well-renowned rehabilitation professionals, strength and conditioning coaches, and athletes come together to discuss the integrated world of performance physical therapy and strength and conditioning. Welcome to another episode of the Performance Rehab and Strength Training Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Jett. And today I'm sitting down with Dr. Dustin Grooms to talk about neuroplasticity associated with ACL injury. Dr. Grooms, I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me here.
Before we get rolling, do you mind giving the listeners a short history about yourself?
Sure. So I started out as I was a computer engineering science major. And then a professor goes one day like, if you don't get really excited about staring at a computer all day, you know, you need to do something else. So I looked to do something else. I found athletic training seemed to be a great field where you get to be outside and you get to work with athletes and learn a lot about medicine and physiology. End up doing a master's degree in University of Virginia. And then after working for a few years clinically, which is something I'm sure you've ran into yourself, Alex, and a lot of your listeners, is that you start to find that there's just limitations to the therapy we can offer. Like, I think you come out of school and you expect you're going to be able to help everyone and you're going to have a big impact and no one's ever going to get re-injured on your watch and everyone's going to have really good outcomes. And you find that just even if you do everything right that the book says, you still, you know, you have kids get re-injured and it's just, it gets heartbreaking after a while. So then I went to do a PhD because I thought I could try to figure it out. And I was, and as anyone who does any research knows that you're not just going to figure it out in maybe even a lifetime. This research moves very slowly and you're just adding little bits of knowledge as you go. And I started out in biomechanics because that's where most of sport and orthopedic medicine is focused around. And then I ended up switching to neuroscience because I started to have questions that biomechanics couldn't answer. So normally use biomechanics to study human movement, but that's really just the output of the whole nervous system computations to move. And it seemed like injuries were happening somewhere before that movement generation, somewhere in the nervous system computations. And so that's what I've been studying the last decade now to try to better understand that and then inform our therapies.
Yeah, I love it, man. And, you know, kind of before we really get specific with some of the details of how rehab can change, kind of how you put it, with the external focus versus more of an internal focus, can you touch on how central nervous system plasticity changes after a musculoskeletal injury and some of the things that come with that?
Certainly. So there in any injury, so it applies to, I just happened to study ACL injury for a few reasons that we can get into. It's a pretty good model. It's a pretty homogeneous injury. It has a high innervation of mechanoreceptors, which tell you about proprioceptor or joint position relative to other ligaments, but all ligaments have an element of these mechanoreceptors, and even muscles and tendons are seeing a very similar approach and a similar change with those injuries. So what we'll talk about today could really apply broadly to a lot of musculoskeletal traumas. And so you really have these two competing ways that the brain can change. You can either change how you're behaving, and over time, your behavior change will change the brain, and then that makes behavior change easier. So this is why picking up a new habit is very difficult, but once you've established a habit, it can be hard to break. The other way the brain can change is you change the afferent or sensory input into the system. And so what we think is happening after an ACL injury, our original theories for people were working on this in the early 2000s was that this was primarily a deafferentation or a loss of afferent information into the nervous system. So you have a ligament, you know, it's 1-5% mechanoreceptors. It's telling mostly spinal cord neurons, how much tension is on the ligament, so you could have a reflex if it gets too taut. So as the ACL gets stretched, a lot of people are familiar, the hamstrings will tend to activate to pull the tibia back and prevent excessive anterior translation. This is all spinal mediated reflex. Mm-hmm. So you got to have mechanoreceptors in the ligament to tell the spinal cord what's happening and to engage in this protective reflex. So those are gone. And then you do the reconstruction, and there's some debate whether you get some reinnervation of afferent fibers, but what it really looks like, there was a great study just recently, you do get some reinnervation, but it's mostly just the pain fibers, which that doesn't really help us very much. So it'll make your second ACL hurt again, but you don't really get the benefit. And then with the injury, though, we also have immediate behavior changes. You get muscle guarding, you change your gait pattern, you have immediate inhibition of your quadriceps in the case of ACL injury, but it's usually the primary muscle that loads the joint tends to get inhibited for any joint injury. And so this causes behavior changes, which in turn reinforce brain changes. So when I first started this, I thought the brain really changed because you lost this afferent information, and that caused this cascade of all these changes. And really, we have this longitudinal study going on now where we're tracking our ACL patients over the course of therapy before they return to sport. And it's actually looking like our therapy and how they're moving and changing after the injury is inducing most of what we see. And so it seems to be this shift, we call it sensory reweighting after this injury, where you normally would rely on proprioception, especially for your legs to move. Because normally you don't look down at your feet, right? When you run and walk and you look at the world. And your spinal cord and your proprioceptors just naturally allow you to engage in this pattern movement. After this injury, you've lost some of that expected sensory information, and you start to reweight towards vision to help you program motion, and you start to engage in more cognitive control of your lower extremity, which is what we would associate with direct voluntary movement. So those are the two big pathways we see neurologically, this shift in how you control your joint, the sensory weighting effect, and then this over-reliance on direct cognition, or like thinking about your knee.
Can you touch on the H reflex a little bit? I know you mentioned that in your webinar when I first was introduced to all of this, and how that kind of affects where, you know, where the rehab will go.
Yeah. So the H reflex is this classic neurophysiologic technique named Dr. Hoffman. And basically what it is, if you simplify it down, it's a way to quantify the stretch reflex. So every clinician knows if I smash the patella tendon, right, with my reflex hammer, I get immediate quadriceps contraction. Mm-hmm. We might grade that, and you would grade it as like, it's not there, you know, bad, it's gone, or it's over, it's too much of a reflex. And then there's like this gray of like normal range. And that's how we would grade it as a clinician, qualitatively. Yeah. The H reflex allows you to put a number on this and tells you how excitable is the spinal cord actually. That's that monosynaptic spinal reflex. So what you do is, we'll take the quadriceps example, you would just stimulate the femoral nerve, and usually do it where it's kind of superficial. So a common place to do it would be in that femoral triangle right at your hip, because you can get access to it. So you stimulate it and you use electricity, and you know how many microvolts I put in to that stimulator. And then it immediately, since it's an exogenous stimulation, it'll go both ways. It'll go down the motor neuron and have a muscle contraction, and it'll go up the afferent neuron to the spinal cord, induce another reflex of contraction. So stimulate, the first thing that happens is, then like 30 milliseconds, it goes to the muscle, you get a muscle contraction, and you put EMG on that. So I can record how much, say I gave it 100 volts, right? And say like 90 volts or whatever made it to the muscle, and that's how much of a contraction I got. And then that 100 volts goes up to the spinal cord. And then we have one synapse there, that monosynaptic reflex, and then it comes back down to the muscle. And then we say there's like, say that's like 30 microvolts, because you lose a lot. That it's mostly an inhibitory neuron, so it's mostly knocking down the afferent signal so you don't have just muscle contractions like crazy. Mm-hmm. And so say maybe you have 30 microvolts. So then you would say, well, 30% of the total stimulus made it through that synaptic reflex, and that would be the level of spinal excitability. So that's a way to think about it. So now we can quantify how excitable is your spinal cord. And what we see is that immediately after an injury, the spinal excitability goes down, gets knocked down. So that's one reason why it's harder to get a contraction. If you're trying to contract your quad, you have two sources of motor control excitability. You can get it from the motor cortex, or you can get it from the spinal cord. And so we know at the spinal cord level, it gets knocked down immediately after the injury. There's a lot of interesting work if people get into like evolutionary biology about why the system was created or evolved, it doesn't, whatever you choose, was designed this way to allow us to function in the world. So if you think about it, before we had reconstructive surgery, you had to shut down the muscle that loaded your joint, or else you would continue to injure that joint. So what's really cool is that the spinal cord just does this for you. It knocks down that quad muscle, and we actually see a shift towards the soleus and the glute max to allow you to walk still. So it was designed to preserve function in the state of an injury so you could survive. But, you know, we have reconstructive surgery, but your nervous system doesn't know we have reconstructive surgery, that there's a new graft in there.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't just re-up my spinal excitability. It can take months for that to come back. And then towards the end of therapy, you'll see actually a depressed motor cortex excitability. And we think that is due to your therapy, where you've trained the person to think about their quad and really focus on it. So it's probably our own therapy is getting the brain used to having this extra input, either from vision or from directly thinking about the joint, to generate a quad contraction. That's what we've done for 6 months. I mean, I think about my own therapy before I went back to study neuroscience. I don't know why I thought it was a good idea to take the knee joint, where you probably thought about it, you know, all of a few minutes your whole life. You take it like a 16-year-old baseball player or any sport. Like, how often are they like thinking about their quadriceps? Like, never, yeah, right?
Yeah,
like,
right.
Like, and then it's like 6 months, just think about this every day, an hour a day. And then you expect them to just like program movement normally without any of that when they go back. Just like, then you're like, just hit the ball. But you've trained me to like think about this muscle for six, you know? And so in hindsight, it's like, why did we ever think that was a good idea? But that's how research goes.
Yeah. So really, how will this dictate where we go from a rehab perspective? We're all used to what you just explained. Like, we've got to get that voluntary quad contraction as soon as possible. We've got to load it early and often. Like, where do we shift in regard to like neuroplasticity and everything you just kind of laid out with the spinal cord and the central nervous system response to injury? Where can we go? And we'll just kind of start day one. They come in, they had surgery last night.
So the first thing, we know the spinal cord's shutting down. And so your primary goal is you want to increase afferent traffic into the spinal cord. And so you have this depression. And so it's two reasons. So one is the ACL is gone, so you've lost afferent input into the system. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that neuron is knocked down a lot. So it goes, oh, there's an injury. We need to stop sending excitability or sending muscle contraction, sending action potentials to the quadriceps. And so how you can overcome that? You can overcome that one of two ways. I can increase drive top down from the brain down, which we just talked about is probably not ideal. We don't want to rely too much on our cortex to generate quad contractions. But or you can increase afferent traffic going in to that monosynaptic reflex and try to overcome the inhibition immediately. And so if you think about a neuron, you know, it's the all or nothing principle, right? Mm-hmm. Either fire or the other fire, right? And so you want to increase the excitatory potentials coming into that synapse so you can make it easier to fire. And so how we do that, you can use TENS, you know, any sort of modality that does afferent stimulus. There's some good studies that if you do cryotherapy, or like they call it cryokinetics was the old term, where you would put it on and then you would do some exercises and put it on. It's because cold receptors have a lot of afferent traffic. So you'll send a lot of impulse. You really feel it when something's cold. So the electrical stim can help a lot of people, especially Dr. Lynn Snyder-McLeod at Delaware. She'll kill me if I don't mention, you got to do like muscle stim can help a lot. And what's interesting about muscle stim, it might just be the afferent signals coming in that help overcome spinal inhibition, not even the muscle contractions itself, which is sort of interesting, because if you have a muscle contraction, you'll send a bunch of afferent impulse to the spinal cord again. Mm-hmm. And your goal is you want to minimize the time that the quadriceps has this inhibition, because the longer you have them inhibited, the more likely they're going to shift to a soleus ankle or a hip glute strategy. Yep. And they'll maintain it. So you're probably seeing a lot of literature lately where people are like, oh, hop distance will be the same between your injured and uninjured people, but your injured people are like generating all from the hip. They have like no knee moment. There's like three or four studies coming out with that. Well, it's probably because they've been trained to use a compensation strategy. So the longer you compensate, the harder it's going to be at the end to try to reverse it or flip it back to try to use their quad and use their knee. And so anything you can do in the very beginning to increase afferent traffic, I try to do it immediately, because I really want them to try to engage their quadriceps as much as they can. The other thing I'll do, and this is sort of person dependent. You're still a clinician. So everything I say, it's just stuff that you're already doing and just trying to like frame it in a little bit different context, maybe even use it earlier, is depends on the patient. But if I can get them to not, it's small, but it seems like we have a couple papers on looking at the change in brain activity if you just change someone's attention. So that's what you alluded to earlier, Alex, mm-hmm. was like internal versus external.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times we allow them to just stare at their quad and generate a contraction. And so the external focus would be you try to give them a target. And so you try to put their attention on like the towel underneath their quad, you know, that they're pressing into, or some target in the world or anything. And what's crazy, and Gabby Wolf at UNLV's done, her whole career has been like these manipulations and seeing how people learn. And even if you have the exact same visual environment, you just subtly change people's attention, it will change their movement mechanics and change their learning rate. And so it may seem inconsequential, like it's not even worth my time to direct their attention to not their joint, but something external. I think it's these little things that add up, and that's what sort of makes like great clinicians from like your average clinician. It's like the buildup of all these tiny things that you can add. And then another thing we've been working on is, we'll talk about this more, I think, when we get later on in the therapy, but we've used stroboscopic glasses, and they're not usually good. They're like glasses that shutter. Mm-hmm. And they're usually not very good early in therapy because you really have to do something where you target something in the visual world with it. But we've had people wear them, and you could set it up so it just blocks out their bottom vision so they can't look down. So we try to remove them from looking down at their quad. Mm-hmm. And that can be okay, but it's really better if you can manipulate their focus of attention while using some modality that increases afferent traffic. And it's actually vibration. I haven't messed with it much lately, but Troy Blackburn at UNC Chapel Hill, he's just published a series of studies where he's shown like tendon vibration and then the vibration plates. These all may help overcome muscle inhibition too. And if you think about it, it makes sense because you're just increasing stimulus into the spinal. And the last thing I'll talk about for early in therapy is we've been working on this smartphone app, and we're a few months away, we'll be able to give out free beta test links. And the reason why we use a smartphone is I want people to be able to use this immediately, because if you have to buy something, it's just not going to happen. And so we'll have people we're trying to do it for various injuries where we'll try to first person immerse them in like their sport of choice during their exercise. So if you're a soccer player, tour ACL, we'll do your straight leg raise, and you'll see someone kick a ball and you do your leg raise in sync with kicking the ball. And you just drop your phone into like a Google Cardboard. If you have upper extremity injury, we use a lot of rock climb videos. So you imagine you're like rock climbing and stuff. And so we try to put you on the field or on some sort of environment so you can't look at your joint, and you get used to programming motion relative to the real world during your basic therapy exercise. So that's a way to remove visual attention too. But if you don't have it yet, you can go to YouTube VR. Actually, there's a lot of free stuff if people want to play around. But it's just a way to manipulate attention if you're not going to be creative and do it in the clinic. It's just a brute force way to do it. But you can approximate that effect just by directing their attention away from the joint.
I want to give a quick shout out to my sponsors, Muscle Up Protein Bars and Gym Aware Training Equipment. Head to the show details and follow the links to receive your discount on all Muscle Up and Gym Aware products. As always, thanks for listening. Increasing afferent input, it's the strategy that the central nervous system is going to create, more as opposed to the strictly training the joint and the muscles about the joint. Because a lot of these injuries are non-contact, and we're seeing the risk for re-injury, and even the contralateral limb is also at risk. So I think that what you're getting into, it's just so important. It's something that's easily neglected when it comes into the neuroplasticity and cortical reorganization after injury.
Yeah, there's not great data linking some of this to re-injury yet. So we have the studies going on right now. It's just a pretty new area. But one thing that I think is sort of telling is there's been a series of studies that if you're returning to elite level sport, you have to recover your quad symmetry, right? And you recover your hop strength. That'll help you. But it's not that protective. And so what a lot of, like, if you look at the Delaware Oslo data, which is probably our best like longitudinal data from Lynn's lab at Delaware, she showed that even if you recover symmetry and hop function, if you don't wait 9 months, then you're still at pretty high risk. Mm-hmm. And what I'm always shocked with is like people will pass the return to sport criteria, and sometimes some studies show their re-injury risk isn't that much better. Now, it is a baseline. You have to have that. But it's just been disappointing, I think, for our field that it's just not as protective as we would hope. So that's exactly gets at what you're saying, Alex, is it's not all about just training the muscle. So I can get your quadriceps back to 80, 80, 90% of your other side, but your re-injury rate might be still as high as it was before. So you're like, well, then there's something else that's obviously being missed here. And I think it is something with how you're programming motion. We had a couple studies where we were looking at concussion. And so we had baseline brain scans of all these kids. It was hundreds of kids. And it was a Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And then I asked them if they had tracked the kids for ACL injuries. That's more what I'm interested in. And they had a few non-contact injuries. And so we looked at the data and those kids that went on to non-contact injuries and those that didn't. So this isn't re-injury, but this is primary injury. Mm-hmm. And we had there's only three or four female soccer players that had non-contact injury. And there's a few males, and the results were pretty similar. So those that went on to experience a non-contact injury, they had less connectivity. So what connectivity means is just how well regions of your brain communicate with each other. And it's just the correlation between the neural activity in each region. So if I take like the hand area of your motor cortex and the sensory cortex hand area, they'd be like 0.8, 0.9 for us, because they are used to working together, right? Mm-hmm. But then if I take like your frontal cortex and you just pick some like random region like your basal ganglia, then the correlation could be like 0.2, very little. They're not used to, actually they kind of work together a little bit, but it'd probably be a lot lower. And so there is this cortical cerebellar connectivity, which is what allows you to correct for sensory errors. And so if you ever are like walking down the street and make a misstep, or you're walking down the stairs, think there's another step or something like that, you trip and you save yourself, right? And you don't fall on your face. You take another step usually. That is entirely a sensory cerebellar connectivity pathway correction. It corrects for a sensory timing error or a sensory prediction error. So what our best data seems to indicate is that our cortex is engaged in this constant prediction algorithm. It's trying to predict what's happening in the world. So the sensory cortex is predicting, I'm going to be on flat ground, but then maybe there's a little pothole or something. It failed to predict it. And if you don't fall and crash, if you correct for it, then the sensory cortex cerebellum, they contracted together to have this correction, because it happens faster than you could just do it if you were just consciously thinking about it. Like if you picture the scenario, you don't look down and go, oh no, I'm about to fall, I need to take another step. No, you just like do it mm-hmm. naturally. And then you like think it comes to your conscious brain later. The cerebellum is what regulates all that. And so the kids that went on to injury, their sensory cerebellar connectivity was very flat. It was like 0.1 or less. And then the kids that didn't go on to injury, the ones we matched them to, they were pretty high, like 0.5 and above is normal. And so these two or three kids, they just didn't have this connectivity and this pathway that corrects for sensory prediction errors, sensory timing errors. So what you just said, perturbation training, is essentially trying to train that pathway. You're inducing a slight error in where your position is, because they don't know which way you're going to perturb them, right? They can't expect it. Mm-hmm. And then they have to correct for it. And a lot of the most successful perturbation training seems to be when they're in a relaxed state, and you can even do it eyes closed so they can try not to predict it as much. And then you're trying to train that pathway. And so I think injury prevention should probably try to incorporate some of that, but definitely injury rehabilitation. And it's hard to know like which kids have that problem. So I would just do it in everyone. I would think of it just like as another thing, like you have your plyometrics, you have your technique training, you have your strength training. Well, like sensory prediction or sensory correction training should be part of it too, especially for non-contact injuries. It's like obvious that those injuries are a nervous system sensory prediction error that they failed to correct for. So mm-hmm. I think when you have the data and you sort of lay it out, I think a lot of it just makes sense for what we've been struggling with for a long time.
Yeah, I think it kind of just goes back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier off the air. There's kind of this gray area with rehab and return to sport. And you know, I don't think this is any different, really. It's just specific to the ACL and rehab in regards to ACL injury. But again, really, you could just pick any pathology or any injury, and there's going to be gray area within that return to sport process. So one of my next questions would be, as far as like that motor control and neuroplasticity perspective, do you have certain markers you look for whenever, you know, you're trying to increase motor control and you think the patient is safe for the introduction and progression of some of this more intense, maybe perturbation training and reactivity type training?
Yeah, it can be tough. So I think this is when it comes to really like where you have to be a clinician again. And I'm not going to be able to just tell you exactly when to do anything, because even when I go and help athletics or anything with a case, like every case is very different. We have some kids who get there quickly and some who don't. What's sort of interesting about some of these data we see with ACL injury is some of our worst performing ACLs, they actually have a brain activation pattern that looks like coordination deficit disorder. Mm-hmm. Which is a disorder for like pediatrics and kids when they're developing, they're like just clumsy kids, mm-hmm. which is kind of interesting that this coordination aspect, neural control wise, has a bit of a connection there. So what's sort of interesting is a lot of those kids that do get injured, they don't have the behavioral presentation of the coordination disorder kids. Like a lot of times it's like your stud athlete who moves really well, who is like really athletic, gets injured. And so it might be that injury induces a similar effect of having a coordination disorder to a level like the injury itself is like a temporary and acute cause of it, which is sort of interesting. Your question on how do you know when they're ready to go? So what I'll do a lot of times is if I'm working with someone and I'm trying to decide how do I know to advance them? So we know pretty well how to advance people on strength training. You like increase the weight slightly and you lower the reps and you see if they can do it. And it's very systematic. So that's one thing strength training has done, I think, really well, is the idea of progression built into their system to develop physical progressions. And it's usually very laid out. People have a very good sense of how to progress people and what to do. You know, you have a few eyes, I can increase the volume, I can increase the resistance, I can modify the exercise, and people have it really well thought out. But this stuff is a little more ambiguous. And so the simplest thing you can do is, first, I'll direct their attention away from the exercise. And so the very minimum thing, so say if I'm having someone do a squat, and I want to know, can they do the squat while they're on a roller board and I'm like perturbing the roller board or giving them perturbations, or if they're ready for a more maybe sport specific challenge. And I'll just like flash numbers at them and I'll tell them to remember the sequence as I do it. So that way their attention's on me and they have to engage in working memory with me. And if their biomechanics go to total crap, then I'm like, oh, well, you're not really neurologically ready to handle an additional load until your mechanics look good when I do a simple dual task with you. And so I'll do this all the time with any exercise. If I'm not sure, if I'm not comfortable with where they're at, and I have a question if I need to advance that exercise to try to move up to maybe a perturbation training or something else, or add strobe glasses or virtual reality or whatever it is, that's usually what I'll do first. I'll just take up working memory and visual attention, make it on me, biomechanics still look good, then I'm more comfortable in moving forward. And to train to that, you can include dual tasks in the exercises. And so what I've done a lot is I'll just have these PowerPoints loaded up all the time. And you can load them on people's phones, put them on tablets, put them on projector screens in the clinic, and it'll just cycle through numbers, colors, words, all kinds of stuff. And you can have people attend to them and do any sort of dual task you want during any exercise. So every time it flips screen, usually flips every 2 seconds, they do a rep, and you could say, you know, add up the numbers or do a rep every time it's even, or you could be as very creative as you want. You use flashcards, you can use yourself. Anytime you can just add that extra external load, that can help you determine if your athlete's ready, but it can also help them train to be ready. So what I'll usually do is, before I advance their physical exercise, I add a cognitive challenge, and then I make sure they can do the exercise well under the cognitive challenge, and then I'll advance the physical exercise, you know, cognitive challenge. I kind of leapfrog it like that.
Yeah, kind of what we mentioned earlier, that augmented rehab, where you're getting that the more of an external focus with some dual tasking or the perturbation training, the vestibular visual activity. Like that would be your marker for progression as opposed to just loading the tissues, man. That's like, that's really what this episode's all about. Like there's your game changer, changing the environment in some capacity to make that athlete react to whatever position you're putting them in. That's what sport is.
There's just
so many variables. You don't know what's going to happen during a game. Like you can't mimic soccer in the clinic. You just can't. But what you can do is manipulate the environment and induce this movement strategy. Right. And then you're getting more of that neuroplasticity, neurocognitive, what we're talking about here. You don't have to have a neurocom in your clinic, right? You can just do what you said. You can throw up fingers, colors, whatever. It's just a game changer in regard to how we're missing the boat as clinicians, I feel like, when it comes to sport.
It's simple. I think once you have the idea, like I have clinicians email me all the time and they've thought of all kinds of crazy stuff. Like one guy put up all the different colored light dumbbells around and he would call out a color. And sometimes it means they have to go to it, but sometimes it means a different exercise. Like blue means lunge, you know, purple means squat. And he's still getting his 3 sets of 10 or whatever he wants to do of each exercise, but he's just prescribing it differently. People get so creative. And your point, like you can't simulate soccer. I mean, that's fair. And I think you're hitting on this, but you're trying to just train the neural pathway, the neural tissue. So think about like cognition, like soccer is extremely cognitively demanding. Like you're trying to track everything that's going on in the field. It's sort of a crazy spin. Most sports have an element of this. Like even if you think about baseball, even if you're a fielder, he's got to think, okay, if the ball goes there, I need to go this way. You know, he has, you know, thousands of strategies to think about. He's not looking at his body. He's tending to the environment. He has a lot of distractions. So even something like baseball, where it may not be as like chaos as soccer, at least continually, because you have the breaks between the pitches, you still want to try to load, think about the neural activity they're going to have to do for the sport, and you want to load it in your therapy. So you might not be training the sport, like you said, but you're training an element of what they need. They need working memory. They need online attention. They need to be able to control their body and attend to the world and engage in cognition. And so I think of it more as you're just trying to train what they'll need for sport. For whatever reason, like you said, we focus so much on the physical impairments. And for sure, if you don't recover range of motion, get rid of swelling, and have some element of strength recovery, a lot of it doesn't matter, right? And so if your patient's struggling for those fundamental things, do what you have to do to get those back. That's like baseline. But as you're trying to think about returning your person to sport, or if you can just add these little things to what you're already doing, then I think that can have a big impact later on.
Dr. Grooms, man, this is absolutely an awesome conversation. I got about 3 pages of notes here. This is great, man. Is there anything you'd like to add here before we wrap it up?
Yeah, the last thing I'd think about is we've been working on a few things for return to sport tests. So we talked about this a little bit, that this is a big gulf and really hard to do. And I think return to sport, one reason why it's tough is a lot of people are showing that we probably don't load our athletes enough towards the end. So this is the bridge of strength and conditioning. Mm-hmm. But the other thing I'll just mention that we've had some success with lately is we try to add a cognitive challenge to our return to sport test. So most of you are familiar with like your HOP tests. And we just published a few papers that shows if you add a small cognitive challenge to the HOP test, you could decrease jump distance in healthy people by like 10%. And so we're doing this in our ACL patients now to see if that decreases more. And what we've done clinically is we want their cognitively challenged HOPs to not drop by any more than 10 for our ACL patients. And if they do, their HOP distance may be symmetric, but if their distance goes down by more than 10% when we cognitively challenge them, then we know they're not ready. So we've added this to our return criteria. And how we do it, we use these fit lights, which will flash colors, and then they'll have a go color and they jump on the go color. And we set them up to challenge different elements of cognitive function. But you're like, you don't have fit lights, that's okay. You actually don't have to use them. What you do is you stand at the top of the tape measure and you'd be like, go on the even number, and you flash it, and you like make them jump on a working memory command, and then that will be a good challenge to see if versus them just jump whenever they want. And so when they have to respond to a cue and keep something in mind and jump and stick the landing, that'll give you an idea of how much they're relying on it based on their jump distance decrease. And then for each hop, we've added a different element. So if you have someone working with you, for like the crossover hop, we'd have people stand on each side of you and you would flash like the go signal could just be an open hand. And one, you or your collaborator could flash it so that we can challenge peripheral vision too. And so we've done, and then the other hops have other similar perturbations. So you can get pretty creative with how you're going to implement it. But I would just encourage clinicians to not only apply this to their exercises, but think about how you can add this extra challenge to your tests to determine if someone's ready to progress and go back to sport, not only physically, but also neurologically, like we've been talking about.
If people want to find anything you're doing from a research perspective or on your socials, website, where can they find you?
Sure, I try to respond to any email. If a clinician emails me, I'll respond to you. It's just Grooms, GROMSD at ohio.edu. And then I am on Twitter at Dusty_Grooms, but I don't get on it too much. But I mean, if you ask me a question, I'll respond. And then I usually send people like PowerPoints to get started if you want to try cognitive loading. And then we're hoping to have free beta testers for clinicians or coaches who want to try some of the virtual reality stuff I mentioned earlier on a phone. So if you're interested in that, then I mean, because I really, really want this stuff to get out to clinicians. When I was a clinician, I always felt like a lot of times researchers just do the work and then there's not like good translation. Like how do you implement stuff without labs and without expensive technology? So I'm really passionate about trying to actually get it out there. So if I can help you and your patient, don't hesitate, let me know. Thanks, Alex.
Yeah, man. Awesome. Again, I'll tag you and everything. And the amount of valuable information just from this 45 minutes here is I can't even put it into words. So again,
thanks, Alex.
Yeah. Again, Dr. Grooms, I appreciate your time and hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Love to. Thanks.
Podcasting is gaining more traction each day. And the beauty is anyone can do it and it will cost you next to nothing to start your own show. I've gotten the opportunity to speak with individuals around the world that share my same passion for sports performance. And I've been able to share my message globally. Without my show, none of those opportunities are possible. Buzzsprout is the hosting website I used to launch my show. With Buzzsprout, you'll get a website that you can link your social media accounts to promote your episodes. You can track your show's stats. They list your show in all major podcast directories like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. And most importantly for me is anytime I've had an issue or simply needed help figuring something out on their site, I reached out to them and they've always gotten back to me that same day to help me resolve the issue. So if you're thinking about starting your own show, I highly recommend using Buzzsprout as your hosting website. If you'd like to learn more, follow the link in the show details or reach out to me directly and I'd be happy to help.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the PRST Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please give the podcast a follow and leave a review. You can also find my content on Instagram and Twitter, where my handle is PRST_PT. And you can also check out my website, agprst.weebly.com.
Thanks for tuning in.